Provost, Mr. Murphy, ladies and gentlemen. The title of my discourse tonight might perhaps better be given as the essence of biography. What is it that makes a novel great? What is it that makes a biography great? This is assuredly the chief test of greatness in a novel or biography, the ability to make personages seem alive. The second test is perhaps only less important. It is the power of relating these characters in not only a significant but a poignant way to some universal laws of human experience. That is, the writer must have a story to tell, a set of experiences to describe, which harmonize with and memorably deepen our own sense of the mingled comedy and tragedy of life. Every great novel does tell a story which deeply engages our emotions. It may be as simple as My Antonia, as realistic as The Old Wives' Tale, as normal and commonplace a piece of fiction as that neglected masterpiece, The Last Chronicle of Barset, as abnormal as the novels of Dostoevsky, or Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, or as sunny as Richard Feverel. At any rate, it must be a story which has a compelling and haunting quality. So it is with the great biographies. We see Dr. Johnson struggling with old age, with his constitutional indolence, with poverty, with his fits of overwhelming melancholy. We see Mark Twain leaping in the audacity of his genius from continent to continent, basking in international renown, storming at human follies, alternating between riotous humor and tragic irony, and then suffering bankruptcy, bereavement of child and wife, loss of faith in his country and in human nature. Or we watch Lytton Strachey's Queen Victoria in her bright years of romance with Prince Albert, and then as they are followed by the iron years of widowhood and conscientious labor. And we see that these stories do touch a universal law of human experience. They are interesting as a series of events, but they are more deeply interesting in their relation to the general human problem. And the deepest, the most poignant biographies are those which relate some tragic experience. It is true that great biographies have been written of figures like Gladstone, Benjamin Franklin, Disraeli, men who lived generally prosperous lives, but they do not touch our emotions, I think, like biographies, short or long as Boswell's Johnson or as short as Mrs. Gaskell's very vivid life of the Bronte sisters, which relate an essentially tragic life story. The principal challenge and delight in the art of biography is the task of characterization. No man ever began to write the life of another without saying to himself, here is a person who moved, thought, felt, and spoke, who was alive to his fingertips, who seemed to some of the people about him, his wife and children at least, the most interesting man in the world. How can I recreate that character? I must understand him myself. First, then by deft touches, I must build up such an understanding in my reader. Alas, how few biographers accomplish that first task of themselves understanding the man they portray. Nothing is more difficult. Charles A. Beard once told me that he had never undertaken a biography because he despaired of ever understanding a man's thoughts and motives. Indeed, a full understanding is unquestionably impossible, for no man ever really understands himself. Quite. We all remember what the elder Oliver Wendell Holmes says in the Autocrat Papers about the three personalities of John. There is first the real John, known only to his maker. There is second, John's idea of himself, which is never the real John, but very different, usually a sort of idealization of John. And third, there is the world's idea of John, which corresponds with neither of the others. As Dr. Holmes points out, there are also three Thomases, so that when John and Thomas talk or exchange letters, six persons are involved. It must be remembered, too, that the John of 30, in all three of his personalities, may be very different from the John of 20, the John of 40, very different again, and so on through life. And John's character may change overnight if he is religiously converted, or falls passionately in love, or is inaugurated President of the United States. The task of understanding a character bristles with difficulties, and at the best only an approximation to the truth is possible. It is evidence of the fascination which the task of characterization has immemorially presented that character study is one of the oldest elements in literature. The first true biographer was Plutarch. His 46 parallel lives of Greek and Roman heroes are primarily studies in personality and character. Plutarch was deficient as a storyteller. Few of his narratives meet our requirement of relating this subject in some significant way to a universal law of human experience. He was not always diligent in research, and of course he knew nothing of the scientific method in its modern sense. As a biographer, his work is also marred by one conspicuously irritating fault. He was keenly interested in the ethical aspect of his heroes' lives, and his sketches are tinged by a great deal of moralizing. But he did have a keen eye for character. He really understood, or thought he understood, most of his personages. And he had a great talent for illustrating his conception of character by the use of revealing human traits. He was able, by a few deft quotations, a little group of incidents, to make the man seem real and human. His interest in human nature was catholic and curious and unending. And he well understood the fact that the individual qualities of a leader influence all his public actions. That as he acts in small and intimate matters, so he will act in great. When we read Plutarch's Lives of Antony and Brutus, we see at once that we are in the presence of the same characters who appear in Shakespeare. And I would emphasize the word characters. That is, it was the humanizing power of Plutarch which fired Shakespeare with the desire to present them as human beings in the theater. Some especially happy illustrations of Plutarch's method may be found in his biography of Alcibiades, that of Caesar, and that of Pompey. Modern writers have given a fuller and more carefully constructed account of these men, but they have added little to Plutarch's depiction of their fundamental traits. Or we may take as an excellent specimen of Plutarch's talent for graphic characterization his 20 pages on Marcus Cato, the elder Cato. He describes the man's arresting personal appearance, his fiery complexion, penetrating gray eyes, wiry figure. He pictures his bellicose manner, his grim, ugly, ill-tempered face, his harsh and thunderous voice. When Cato marched against Hannibal, he went on foot, carrying his own arms, with but one servant to bear his provender. He ate little and drank nothing but water, perhaps mixed with a little vinegar. On the farm, he toiled with his own hands among his slaves, and at mealtime sat with them, eating their coarse food. His breakfast, says Plutarch, never saw the fire. The meat which he bought in person in the marketplace for his supper was coarse in quality and small in quantity. Not one of his farmhouses was more than a rude hut. None was even plastered. When a piece of Babylonian tapestry was left him, he sold it. He got rid of his slaves when they grew old, for it was his rule to feed no useless servant. He reckoned nothing a good bargain that he could do without. When he governed Sardinia, he walked from town to town, dispensing with a carriage. He spoke roughly and sententiously, rebuking the commoners of Rome, who were clamoring for corn. He began with his harangue with the words, "It is a difficult task, O citizens, to make speeches to the belly, which has no ears." And chiding an old man who was committing some evil act, he remarked in his salty manner, Friend, old age has of itself blemishes enough. Do not you add to it the deformity of vice. Detesting philosophy, he used to abuse Socrates as a prating, seditious fellow who had done his best to tyrannize over Athenian opinion. When we have read these 20 pages, we do not like or admire Cato the Elder, but we feel that we know his character. In English biography, too, we meet skill in characterization long before we meet accurate and thorough research or ability to tell an effective life story. No better illustration of this fact can be found than the admirable volume of Characters in 17th Century English Literature, edited by Professor Nicol Smith of Oxford. This being a collection of brief but pungent and generally excellent character sketches from Lord Clarendon, Bishop Burnet, the historian, and similar writers. Or we can find illustrations even earlier in such authors as John Aubrey, whose work has so recently been reprinted, and Isaac Walton and Roger North. All three men belonged to that school of anecdotal historians concerned chiefly with the illumination of character, which can be traced back directly to Plutarch. Aubrey made a particularly valuable contribution to the art of biography, for he had a keen eye for significant detail and a still keener relish for a significant story. He cared little for a long train of facts, but a great deal for an illuminating incident. Nor was he afraid to blurt out the truth. As he wrote a friend, he willingly set down many passages that would raise a blush in a young virgin's cheek. He liked to touch upon an idiosyncrasy. Thus, he tells us that Francis Bacon had so active a mind that he was often wakeful at night and frequently took a great draught of strong beer just before going to bed to quiet his intellect, as Aubrey puts it. He relates that Milton pronounced the letter R very hard. This being, says Aubrey, the certain sign of a satirical wit. He states that Sir Walter Raleigh, who spoke broad Devonshire, was rather rough in his ways. Once he took a perpetual talker, grabbed a handful of hot sealing wax, and smearing it into the man's mustache and beard, sealed up his mouth. In sketching William Butler, the eminent physician, Aubrey tells how he responded to the repeated low bows of a too courtly Frenchman by whipping his leg over the man's lowered head and walking off. Writing of Bishop Corbett of Oxford, he relates that Corbett was once confirming some country people when a man with a very bald, shining head appeared before him. Turning to his chaplain, Lushington, the bishop said, "Bring me some sand, Lushington, to keep my hand from slipping." The same bishop once accosted a man with a great, venerable beard. "You there," said the bishop, "behind that beard." It was this keen eye for characteristic statement, anecdote, which led Strachey to say that a biography should be either as long as Boswell's or as short as Aubrey's. Indeed, nearly all the biographies and autobiographies written in English in the 16th and 17th centuries emphasized character. Isaac Walton's Lives of John Donne, George Herbert, Richard Hooker, and the other worthies are really extended character sketches. So are Roger North's Lives of his three brothers, Lord Herbert of Cherbury and his famous autobiography, of which William Dean Howells has given us one very engaging edition with a perceptive introduction. Presents quite unconsciously a very revealing self-portrait. The book, in fact, is perhaps the greatest piece of self-conceit ever penned. Lord Herbert tells us that when he was a child, he knew how to talk long before he uttered a word. For, he writes, "I did forbear to speak, lest I utter something that was imperfect or impertinent." He tells us that when Queen Elizabeth saw him as a youth, she swore her usual oath, which I believe was God's blood, and declared it was a pity that he had married so young. She being still unmarried. At the siege of Juliers in France, he and the French officer had a trial of bravery. Both sprang into the open space between the trenches. There they stalked up and down under a brisk fire from the two lines. As the bullets whizzed past, the French officer remarked, "It's very hot here," and suggested going back. "You shall go first," the intrepid Herbert exclaimed, "or else I shall never go." And the Frenchman, crouching low, then turned and ran. "But," writes Lord Herbert, "I followed after, leisurely and upright."